Friday at 5 p.m.
Drum roll, please.
My favorite time of the week, although it's not my favorite temperature at the moment.
No, we should be somewhere warm.
But I'll live with that. I'm glad to be here at WHPC 90.3 FM in Garden City, New York. Time for American Hit Radio.
I'm Tom Ryan.
What's that?
I said, I'll live with it, too. It's better than the alternative.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Kind of like what this show is about, how time passes and you want to basically be around to witness as much of it as you can. I'm Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host Heidi Morales Ryan, as you hear, of course, with me as well. And the Friday show we call How Music Changed, and we just finished up doing a whole series on Eric Clapton. We start a brand new one today, and it's time for the Wayback Machine again, as I call it, when we go really far back to the beginning, because the whole point of How Music Changed.
Sound effects for that.
Yeah, really.
Whoop, whoop, whoop.
Well, the point of what we did is we picked 250 different artists and or labels, events, that sort of thing. 250 specific things that we consider to be among the most important in the history of recorded music. Arranged them somewhat chronologically. And we'll go back from one to the very, very, very beginning, and then we'll go to the one from the midpoint, and we sort of like go back and forth and crawl toward the present, so to speak. Crawl is probably the right word because we do so many shows on so many of these topics. But I do it that way because if I just stayed and I did them all in pure chronological order, we'd still be discussing, for the past 5 years, I'd be discussing nothing but the 1920s, and I think it would drive people nuts.
I think so.
So what I want to do is basically see if I can get people to listen along with me to some of the hip or newer stuff, or at least what's reasonably new in comparison. And then when we go back, hopefully you're willing to pick up on some of the history. And that's what this show is about, because we're going to go back and we're going to discuss the Carter family. Now, when I was thinking about it today, about what I wanted to say, I mean, I came up with this. You know, these days, there's an entire generation who think of the good old days as a time, say, before the interstate was always bumper to bumper, or when you could shop in a store with less than 30 aisles in it, or you know, maybe when you could hear new hit songs on your transistor AM radio. But for this series, we're going much further back than that, to a time when a previous generation had very different things come to mind when thinking about the good old days.
Mm.
For a previous generation, they were probably trying to recall a time when the road leading to your town was unpaved, or when you bought your groceries at the same place where you picked up your mail, and you heard new music by listening to your neighbor pick out a tune from a new piece of sheet music. This is the world that we cover in this series, the world of the Carter family. Only their existence was even more rural, even more distinctly American than most of us can even imagine. They began their career at a time when the recording industry was still trying to get a foothold on American culture, when a horse was still a practical substitute for an automobile. Songs were overheard and gathered by those who were capable of remembering them well enough to play them and sing them, even if, maybe especially when, some artistic license was taken with the bass material. American music as we know it was built on the backs of music like this. In this series, we hear the very invention of what would come to be known as country music, but it is also so much more than that. This is the beginning tale of the Carter family. I'm going to bring most of my quotes from a really well-written book that I'm reading, a book that actually made the National Book Critics Circle finalist list. It's called Will You Miss Me When I'm Gone? The Carter Family and Their Legacy in American Music. It's written by Mark Zwanitzer and Charles Hirschberg. And it's hard to believe it, but I've actually found it to be something of a page-turner. When we were doing our work with Eric Clapton, this is what I've been reading to prepare myself. So hopefully there'll be some. If I don't do the book justice, it's because I'm obviously not going to be reading all 400 and some odd pages of the book. I'm obviously going to be jumping from section to section. So if it seems a little bit herky-jerky from time to time, I apologize for that. Well, let's start with the book. The Carters aren't dusty old relics trapped on 78s. 75 years after they first cut their voices into wax cylinders, their music is still finding an audience. Carter Family recordings have sold millions of copies and continue to be remastered and remarketed to this day. For the past 10 years, the Rounder label has been re-releasing original Carter Family recordings. Just last year, the Bear Family Records of Germany put out a boxed set of nearly 300 of the Carter Family's original recordings. Carter Family songs like Wildwood Flower, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, John Hardy and Worried Man Blues have been making new hits through eight decades for stars such as Woody Guthrie, Earl Scruggs, Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Johnny Cash, Emmylou Harris, Linda Ronstadt, Lucinda Williams. To this day, the Carters' music is celebrated at festivals from Australia to the upper reaches of Canada, in Europe and Asia, from Newport, Rhode Island to Alaska. Above all, the Carters proved that simple songs about the lives of ordinary people can be as beautiful, as profound, and as lasting as music studied in conservatories. The border stations that billed them as the original Carter Family, because a dozen years' worth of enormously popular recordings had spawned scores of imitators. The Virginia-based trio had been willed into being by Alvin Pleasant Delaney Carter, a gangly, peripatetic man nearing his 50th birthday, AP, as he was best known to his listening audience, provided an inexhaustible supply of songs, many of which he collected from Appalachia's remote mountain homesteads, as well as from its mills, factories, boarding houses, and coal mines, and then worked them up with his wife, Sarah, and his sister-in-law, Maybelle. It was Sarah's rich, expressive alto that had first attracted a producer from Victor Records. At 40, she was still a riveting dark-eyed beauty. Maybelle, the 29-year-old guitar player, was the virtuoso of the group, a fact which astonished many listeners of the 1930s who would not believe that the agile licks and infectious rhythms were conjured by a woman. Yeah. Almost any music lover living in rural America at the time heard broadcasts, including an entire generation of future country stars. Chet Atkins, as a 14-year-old living in Columbus, Georgia, listened in on a battery-powered radio he'd built from mail-order parts. In a little more than 10 years, Atkins would be a struggling musician hired out of obscurity by Maybelle Carter. The future architect of the Nashville sound always credited Maybelle with saving his nearly stillborn career. In a farmhouse in DS, Arkansas, Johnny Cash listened also, never suspecting that he would one day marry Maybelle's daughter, June, who was already appearing on the broadcasts, yodeling her 11-year-old lungs out on the old Texas trail. 20 years later, Johnny Cash would make Maybelle Carter and her three daughters part of his roadshow. He would also credit her with saving his life. In Littlefield, Texas, a small boy named Waylon Jennings would watch his daddy pull the family truck around the side of the house, pop the hood, and hook up the family radio to the pickup battery. Waylon would never forget the Carters' swirling harmonies. And after he and Willie Nelson had re-oxygenated the stagnant country music pond with their stripped-down outlaw style, both would pronounce Maybelle the queen of country music. The Carters were possessed of a thorny ambition that grew even in the most unlikely American soil. From two remote and still valleys, they made themselves known to half a world. That was no mean feat in the 1930s, and it didn't just happen. To varying, sometimes conflicting degrees, A.P. Sarah and Maybelle chased fame and fortune. They were, to quote a song lyric, that they may be the finest distillation of the American character ever written, quote, searching for the water from a deeper well. They didn't choose the easy path. The Carters won fame, if not fortune, because they could recast the traditional music of rural America for a modern audience. And like their music, the Carters themselves had to negotiate the gap between the insular culture of pre-industrial Appalachia and the newly modern America, sort of what I was talking about in the beginning. Their lives were marked by the sheer want of rural existence, lack of a decent paved road or a decent school or cash money, by drought, flood, disease, meager harvest, and plain old loneliness. But their lives were also marked by the frantic demands of an American industry inventing itself. Work in the music business required regular travel for shows all through the remote backwaters of the South, and recording dates in Louisville, Atlanta, Chicago, Camden, New Jersey, and New York City. Moreover, it demanded of them product. AP had to go out into those Appalachian hills and scare up 20 or 30 new songs a year to feed the hungry maws of the record company and their fans. In the 20s and 30s, there was nothing simple about bridging these two different worlds. The cost of trying was dear. And all of this is reflected in the Carter songs, which are mostly about life's buffeting, about love and longing, hurt, loss, and suffering. In fact, it was precisely that clear-eyed and unwavering focus on the hard art of living that gave them such wide-eyed appeal. In the beginning, there were two Carter boys, brothers, who had ambition, if not focus. Those sons seemed to understand that the old mountain ways were about to be overrun, and some folks were going to get run over, and some were going to hop on the train. Those boys were Molly Carter's oldest, who was called Pleasant, and Ezra, called Eck. Eck was shy. He didn't speak a word until he was three, and not many more after. But from the jump, he had a gift for invention. "Oh, Lord," says his niece, Lewis Helmsley, "Ezra had a busy mind." But the strangest case of the entire Carter brood was the firstborn, Alvin Pleasant Carter. Pleasant shook all the time. From the day he was born until the day he died, he was possessed of a slight tremor, most noticeable in his hands. The family named it palsy and never saw cause to better Molly's own theory. Like most mountain women, Molly turned for answers to God and nature. Whenever anybody asked about this odd, shaky child, she would tell them about the day when she was pregnant with Pleasant and got caught outside in a thunderstorm while gathering apples from a fallen tree. A crack of lightning hit the tree she stood beneath and traveled like wildfire along the ground all around her, and as she reckoned, shot such a bolt of fright into her swollen belly that the baby inside would be afflicted with that very nervous energy for each and all of his days. Sometimes Maya would say her eldest son had been marked. What that meant, nobody was quite sure, but it must have given some comfort to a little boy with a difficult row to hoe. It was a matter of speculation whether his head bobbed from the act of walking or the act of thinking. Pleasant took so many notions that they tumbled over one another and fought for space at the front of his mind. He had a hard time ever keeping a single idea front and center and rarely saw one through to completion. He was forever leaving chores undone. As a grown man, he would practice a variety of trades: farmer, sawyer, fruit tree salesman, choir leader, carpenter, music recording professional, and proprietor of a general store whose hours were neither regular nor predictable. He never did seem to care much about his income. When he found himself in some personal bonanza, he'd buy more land or a sawmill. 40 years after his death, his family still doesn't have a definite inventory of the sawmills he owned. AP was always a step out in left field, one of his nephews remembers. Wifty is how one niece describes him. Finally, and most notably, the ever-present tremble gave AP's voice a slight quaver so that when he spoke, it was like a ripple on a pond. And when he sang, it was faster, like the shimmering rush of a mountain creek over mossy rocks below. All these things, everyone in the valley agreed, were on account of the lightning. By the time Pleasant was 20, Flanders Bayes was teaching singing schools all over southwestern Virginia. Uncle Fland, as he was known, was much under the spell of James Vaughn, a publisher who's close-harmonizing gospel quartets with the new musical sensation of Southern choirs. 4 or 5 times a year, a new gospel composition book would arrive at the Bayes home from a publishing house in Lawrenceburg, Tennessee. Then Fland would load up his horse with dozens of fresh new songbooks and head out through Hamilton Gap to the other side of Clinch Mountain, or further out to Washington County or Russell. "He had a burning desire for music and to see people saved," says Fland's son Vernon. "He'd always open his schools with prayer and with a short Bible reading, and he closed it with prayer. It was a devotional religious service." Next to the annual revival, Fland Bay's Dollar a Day Singing School was the biggest event of the year in hidden away hamlets all over that pinched corner of Virginia. On the north side of Clinch Mountain in Copper Creek, there might be 30 or more people who'd sign up for the school. They'd sometimes travel from neighboring towns and bed down with relatives for the chance to cram into the Saratoga schoolhouse every day for 4 or 5 hours, 10 days straight, learning how to read shape notes, how to master their voices, and, as they advanced, how to use those voices in the close harmonies of Southern gospel. Everybody would go, says Daphne Stapleton, who went with her girlfriend Maybelle Addington, later Carter. All the young people would go to learn the notes and to sing up the scale and back down. Flan Bays wasn't one to put on airs. He often presided over the school in his denim overalls, but he was never lax about the music. He always taught us to be able to read 3 notes ahead, says Ruby Parker. You would be singing notes to music, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, 8 notes, and Flanders Bays would stand right over you and just listen, and when you missed a note, he'd stop you that quick. He could catch a sound as quick as anything. He'd knowed his stuff, buddy. Sometimes, if Pleasant could get free of his farm chores, he'd go to his uncle's singing schools to help out. He'd willingly walk down the valley toward Hilton's, then over Clinch Mountain, across Moccasin Valley, over Moccasin Creek, and across Moccasin Ridge to Copper Creek. That would be a difficult day-long trip. But once Pleasant was there, he could stay as long as he wanted. Molly Carter had been born on that side of the mountain, and she had family there yet. Besides, travel suited him. He could walk all day in solitary contemplation, never minded being alone, and loved seeing what was around the next bend in the trail. It was his musical uncle who rescued Pleasant. Flanders was acting as an agent for the Larky Nursery, selling fruit trees and house shrubs around Mesa Springs, so pretty soon he had his eldest nephew selling for the nursery too. But Pleasant wasn't content with the trade in Poor Valley. One day in 1914, with his leather side pouch, his subscription booklet, and a color catalog of hand-painted pictures of fruit and flowering trees, Pleasant Carter walked over Clinch Mountain to try for some sales by Copper Creek. Somebody had suggested he try his mother's cousin, Milburn Nichols. The Nichols home was even farther than the Saratoga School, but Pleasant must have thought it would be worth the extra effort. It's a long, muscle-searing walk over Clinch Mountain, and the trip to Copper Creek probably took a few days. But as he crested the last little hill where he could just see Aunt Susie's house, Pleasant Carter heard singing coming from inside it. The way he'd tell the story later, the music quickened his weary step. It was deep for a woman's voice, but a woman's voice for sure. Aunt Susie had one of those tall, old-fashioned sewing machines, and I was standing beside it, and my auto harp was on top of it, and I was just kind of playing around with it, the owner of that voice would recall many years later. I remember I was singing Engine 143, an old song I learned as a little girl, and this fellow knocked on the door. Let's hear a couple of songs at this point right now by the Carter family. First, let's hear Clinch Mountain Home.
Far away on the hill to a sunny mountainside, many years ago we parted, my little Ruth and I, from the sunny mountainside. She clung to me and trembled when I told her we must part. She says, "Don't go, my darling, it almost breaks my heart to think of you so far, far. Carry me back to old Virginia, back to my Clinch Mountain home. Carry me back to old Virginia, back to my old mountain home. Well, let it hold. Head up on my breast, I told her I would wed her when I came back from the west at my old Clinch Mountain home. In my hand I hold a picture of the old home far away, in the other one my sweetheart I'm thinking of today on the sunny mountainside.
Carry me back to old Virginia, back
back to my Clinch Mountain home. Carry me back to old Virginia, back to my old mountain home. Well, my mother's old and feeble, my father's getting gray. I'm going back to Virginia, and I expect to stay at my old Clinch Mountain home. Carry me back to old Virginia, back to my Clinch Mountain home. Carry me back to old Virginia, back to my old mountain home.
Song about the Clinch Mountains.
Nice.
Right there, obviously. And that's a song that actually, again, like Pleasant was a song gatherer. That's a song that he actually heard while he was doing that walking that we were talking about. One of his sister, Virgie, said that he actually returned with his first song in his pocket. And that was actually it, his first song. But on, like I said, on that other trip, second trip, when he's walking across the mountain, this is when he heard that voice. And as it's told, quote, "I remember I was singing Engine 143, an old song I learned as a little girl, and this fellow knocked on the door. Pleasant motioned for her to go on singing, and then stood very nearly still in Susie Nichols' front room, watching the young woman. Sarah Doherty was only 16 and still wore her long brown hair down over her shoulders. Well, it was Sarah's voice that first drew him. Pleasant said it was the way her dark eyes held a constant play of sparkling light that transfixed him. He listened to the entire song, a ballad about a train engineer burned to death in a bloody train wreck while trying to make up lost time. The engineer, it seems, hadn't listened to his mother's caution, and he ended up in a lonesome grave pining for the engine he loved. I remember that he stood there while I sang, recalled Sarah, and then he said something like, 'Ma'am, that was mighty pretty playing and singing, and I sure would like you to play that over again for me.' And so I did." Here's that track, actually, when it was recorded by the band, Engine 143. Bye.
my darling boy, be still. Your life may yet be saved, if it is, God bless it will. Oh no, said George, that will not do. I want to die so free. I want to die for the engine I love, 143. The doctor said to George, your life cannot be saved. Murdered up on a railroad and laid in a lonesome grave. His face was covered up with blood, his eyes you could not see. And the very last words for George said was, dear, my God, to thee.
Sarah, of course, featured as the solo vocalist on that recording of Engine 143.
That's a great song.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Now, Sarah was one of five children, born on July 21st, 1898, just north of Copper Creek in Wise County, where her father ran a shift at a sawmill in a growing coal mining camp. But her mother, Elizabeth, died of typhoid when Sarah was just three, and that family was lost. The three Doherty sons, Bob, Nathan, and Stephen, spent their childhoods shuttling among friends and relatives, while Sarah and her older sister were sent to live with their mother's sister and her husband. Sevier was often at that house to see them, but he was never a steady presence in their daughters' lives. That's their father, of course. Whatever hurt Sarah suffered as a parentless child, she kept inside. Singing the ballads of death and dying, of family members cold in their graves, of orphan children, lonely women, and jailed men, seemed one of the few releases she allowed herself. Besides, what she liked best, although it was not always easy to see, was being in the middle of fun. Around Copper Creek, that was never very hard. Some afternoons, Sarah would walk over to Ethel Bush's house to listen to Ethel and her friend Eb Easterling play their five-bar auto harps. They used to show me a lot about playing. I was just a little girl then, less than 10 years old, I guess, Sarah once said. I was about 10 or 12 when I got my first auto harp. I sold greeting cards to raise money and ordered it from the Sears Roebuck catalog for about $8 or $10. It was an 8-bar. Playing an instrument put Sarah right in the swim of the Nichols house. Music was the fun in that house, as present as oxygen, and free to boot. Most days, Uncle Mill would rise before the sun, start the fire, pick up his fiddle, and play for an hour. It wasn't long before Sarah was able enough on the banjo to join in, and then she was hooked for good. Before Sarah reached her teens, she had already formed a girl group with her cousin Madge Addington. Madge's home was a 5-minute walk up the hill, and in that house, musical instruments didn't have to be improvised. The Addingtons had a banjo, a guitar, a 5-bar auto harp, and an old-timey organ. Madge and Sarah both played guitar, banjo, or auto harp, so they switched off, playing old ballads and gospel songs. In the first years of the 20th century, older folks all over Rich Valley had songs to sing, and they were happy to share them with eager young girls, such as Madge and Sarah. In Sarah's childhood, before the phonograph, music was passed around Rich Valley in two ways. The first was a straight lineal transmission. Old fiddle airs and archaic Scotch-Irish ballads came across the ocean with forebears and were passed down through generations. Each generation added or subtracted verses to fit the times, but the songs retained a general integrity. When the local fiddlers played tunes at frolics, the songs were pretty close to the ones being played in North Carolina or Georgia or Texas, or even out in Montana, where the Welsh and the Irish were flocking to the mines. And also, pretty close to the old airs, still being played in Liverpool or County Cork. Ballads worked the same way. Around Copper Creek, old folks sang The Storms Are on the Ocean or Sailor Boy Song in the unaccompanied ancient modal way, with a high nasal delivery, favorite in the old world. But when Sarah was a girl first learning the auto harp, a more modern mode of transmission was taking root. New, professionally written songs were traveling too. Old minstrel shows in the newer vaudeville and physics shows would come through Scott County. And even if the denizens of Copper Creek couldn't make it to the big town for a show, the music made its way around. After any show, sheet music was made available to the audience. The bigger touring vaudeville shows had rafts of sheet music sold by the page or by the book. Even self-employed minstrels sold their songs on ballots they had printed up. So somebody might come to Copper Creek from the Gate City Theater carrying a new song to sing. The songs felt like their own, too, because newer songs written by Tin Pan Alley professionals owed much to the imagery and the sentiment of traditional Anglo-Irish ballads. The new songs leaned heavily on mother and home and the leaving of same, lonely wandering in the cruel, cruel world and dying wishes. The songs also owed much to the first great American tragedy, the Civil War. In the four decades since peace had been made, the war's horror and heartbreak had been furiously commercialized. Already in full swing was the American way of selling a story back to the people who had been touched by it. And songwriters made great and sometimes beautiful songs from awful memories of that war. Loss of life, loss of love, loss of home were copyrighted, printed up, and offered for pocket change. The beauty was, no matter where Americans lined up on the conflict itself, the experience of it was much the same. According to Sarah, a neighbor named Myrtle Porter taught her a song about a girl whose once ardent young lover had forsaken her. Nobody knows the exact words Miss Porter left to Sarah, but according to scholar Charles Wolfe, they were most likely based on a song written a half century earlier by Maud Irving and J.P. Welch called "I'll Twine Mid the Ringlets." As Irving and Welch wrote it, the opening verse went, "I'll twine mid the ringlets of my raven black hair, the lilies so pale and the roses so fair, the myrtle so bright with an emerald hue, the pale arenatus with eyes of light blue." It's impossible to know if anybody in Rich Valley still had the published sheet music, but the song itself had been passed around from local singer to local singer. Over the years, it was delivered again and again with scores of musical midwives. It came out sounding different nearly every time. Albert Easterling of Nicholsville would claim for years that he'd written the song from scratch. He made that claim without fear of lawsuit and without shame. Songsters like Albert were constantly retuning and rewording. And given Appalachia's oral tradition and the dense thicket of romantic poetry, the transmission of the song became a game of transgenerational telephone. What was whispered in at one end of the line came out the other end in sometimes nonsensical little couplets. By the time Sarah popularized the song in 1928, the first line had become, "I'll twine with my mingles," as opposed to "I'll twine mid the ringlets," a line without literal meaning. And the myrtle became bright with emerald dew. The pale arenatus was now the pale and the leader, whatever that was. A later line, "The crowd I will sway," made its way onto the record as, "In his crown I will sway." But what made it loud and clear, though, through all the ancestral noise, was the point of the song, that a woman ought to show a fierce and stoic pride in the face of rejection. That song was called Wild Woodflower. Here it is by the Carter Family.
Black hair, with the roses so red and the lilies. flower.
Song that went, like I said, through so many changes, but that was right there, a version which is already like light years away from where it originally started, probably in Europe, and then it ends up now being like this really one of the most covered songs in country music. Now, happily, the music Sarah grew up with wasn't all about life's dark hours. It had a good bit to say about grabbing fun where you could or just plain having fun with the song. A song called Chewing Gum took pot shots at the newly puffed up middle class. Here's some lyrics of the track. I wouldn't marry a lawyer. I'll tell you the reason why. Every time he opens his mouth, he tells a great big lie. I wouldn't marry a doctor. I'll tell you the reason why. He rides all over the country, and he makes people die. I took my girl to church last night. What do you think she'd done? She walked right up to the preacher's face and chewed her chewing gum. Here's that song, Chewing Gum.
Mommy sent me to the springs, told me not to stay. I fell in love with a pretty little girl, could not get away. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Give me 50 cents, kiss me on the stairs. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Mommy don't allow me to whistle, Papa don't allow me to sing. They don't want me to marry, I'll marry just the same. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. I wouldn't have a lawyer, I'll tell you the reason why. Every time he opens his mouth, tells a great big lie. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Doctor, I'll tell you the reason why. He rides all over the country and makes the people die. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. I wouldn't have a farmer, I'll tell you the reason why. Because he has so plenty to eat, especially pumpkin pie. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum. I took my girl to church last night. How do you reckon she done? She walked right up in the preacher's face and chewed her chewin' gum. Chawin', chewin' gum, chewin', chawin' gum.
That was shameless.
Brilliant for its time. I mean, it's so funny. I mean, if you think about these things, especially in regard to the guitar, but we'll get to that as we move on. But there's a real genius that's at the kernel of every one of these songs. Now, nobody really knows what melted Sarah's initial resistance to AP. Joe Carter figures that his father flattered his mother, told her how pretty she was and how smart. But over the years, Joe has developed a jaundiced view of romance, and that clouds his vision. Neither Sarah nor AP confided the details of their courtship. What little evidence there is comes from something Sarah told a fan who caught her off guard nearly 50 years after the wooing commenced. AP's main savior was his bass, Sarah said. I think he was the best. I've never heard anybody that could sing bass like him. Mm-hmm. For AP's part, he was pole-axed in love, and he wasn't going to give up. Even so, the courtship wasn't always easy. First, there was the simple fact that AP had to walk a day or more over one mountain, two more ridges, and a half dozen creeks, or lesser streams, just to get to the Nichols homestead. And like any 16-year-old beauty, Sarah could be aggravating. Ezra Addington often saw pleasant tied-in knots. Sometimes when AP was visiting Copper Creek, he'd stay with Ezra. Ezra always remembered the time Sarah took umbrage at something AP had done and refused his company altogether. He sent his dog up, Ezra Addington recalled years later, put a letter of apology on the dog's collar to ask if he could come and see her. That's the way he got in. Alvin Pleasant Carter and Sarah Doherty were married on June 18, 1915, the month before the bride's 17th birthday. After the ceremony and the dance that followed, Pleasant loaded up his one-horse wagon and carried his new bride back to Poor Valley. They had to ford the winding Moccasin Creek five times just to get to the gap that led out onto the south side of Clinch Mountain. I know that was a wonderful trip home, their daughter Gladys wrote years later. Daddy always walked over the mountain as it was so much closer to go courting, but now he was bringing her home with her auto harp, all of her fancy crochet pieces, quilts, a few dishes. And Aunt Nick picked out 12 of her nicest pullets and a rooster and put them in a coop on back of the wagon. They would be settling down with their horse, a milk cow called Old Bryn, two good squirrel dogs, a good 12-gauge shotgun, their chickens, a step stove, table, four cane-bottom chairs, two iron beds, and a new dresser with a big mirror in it, very rare in those days. In a new little two-room cabin, which Daddy, his brothers, father, and all the neighbors had pitched in to build as soon as he told them he was going to bring his bride home in so many days. He had to have his house on his own little tract of land. Now, Sarah's friends loved her best for her solidity and her self-assurance. She might be quiet, but she was not to be crossed, and she did as she pleased. Like a lot of her girlfriends who worked so hard and so ably, she felt whatever freedom she wanted to take was her due. She might be bonded to work, but the bondage stopped there. Her granddaughters liked to say that Sarah was liberated before there was such a thing. She hunted and fished. She wore pants and smoked cigarettes. She danced if she wanted, even when her husband caviled. This liberation wasn't an idea Sarah and her friends got from women's magazines. It came right out of life. They had earned the right to do as they pleased, and they did. The older women didn't cut their hair, says Sarah's granddaughter, Flo Wolf. It was biblical. A woman should never cut her hair. Sarah had long hair when she moved to the valley. Then Sarah, Myrtle Hensley, Dicey Thomas, and Ed Vangie, who all buddied around, they decided to cut their hair short and didn't tell any of the men. The men probably didn't like that too much. Whatever the men thought, it wasn't of much consequence. The deeply religious Pleasant may have been chastened by his wife's newly bobbed hair, but all he could do was take the flowing and now discarded mane of hair and put it in a place for safekeeping. The bottom line was, AP and Sarah annoyed each other. But AP needed his wife like he needed air. He adored her, though he'd never figured out how to tell her, and not least for her musical talent. As soon as she moved over the mountain, Sarah had joined in with Fland Bay's choir at Mount Vernon. When they went to singing conventions, Fland always wanted Pleasant and Sarah along. In the 20s, singing conventions drew church choirs from all over Southwest Virginia. Hundreds of people would gather in front of a rigged-up stage while a dozen choirs or trios, quartets, and quintets awaited their own call. At Gate City singing conventions, they even had a printed program with a listing of all the groups and the songs they would sing. The stage would be set on the courthouse steps, and the main street had to be closed to the traffic. At the conventions, Sarah would not only sing, she'd also accompany the choir on the auto harp. Ruby Parker remembers how Sarah's lone contralto could move an entire gathering. Everybody at the courthouse would be standing up, had their hands up in the air, Ruby says. She could get down so low. She was a special talent. The first song Mother ever sang in public as a solo was in Bland County, Virginia, Gladys said. She was there with Daddy and Uncle Flan Bays at a singing convention. They asked if anyone would volunteer for a song, so she took up the harp and sang The Wandering Boy. She said that the people came around and gave her money. Here's a recording of that track by the Carter family, The Wandering Boy.
Out in the cold world and far away from home, somebody's boy is wandering alone. No one to guide him and keep his footsteps right.
Wandering Boy by the Carter family, although at this point in time in our story, we've got husband and wife, AP and Sarah. We've got one member to go. AP was starting to understand that music could mean money. And what with money being pressed into her palm, Sarah wasn't oblivious to it either. Still, it was only an extremis that she would pass the hat. In 1925, AP and Sarah borrowed X Carr, his brother, to visit Buff and May, who had moved to Charlottesville. On the way home, they barely made it out of Charlottesville when the car broke down. Dead broke and stranded more than 200 miles from home, AP asked Sarah for suggestions about raising cash. All I know to do is sing, Sarah said. So AP got the permission of the local preacher, booked a schoolhouse, and told the town storekeeper to put out the word. They were going to give an entertainment. By the time they had finished, Pleasant and Sarah had raised enough money to get the car fixed and had some left over when they got home. Still, for Sarah, music was mainly fun for playing with friends and neighbors. Maybe the local postman, Price Owens, would join in, or Clay Vermillion. they'd make music right in that little cabin at the foot of Clinch Mountain, and people would amble over to sit on the porch and listen. Then Sarah would invite them in for blackberry cobbler. The music got to be even more fun when her cousin visited from Rich Valley. The girl was just a teenager, but she'd already made herself a queen of the guitar. She even had a way of plucking out the rhythm part under her own melody. Add Sarah's lush voice and her auto harp, and there was no better music in either valley. The two were so good that a local teacher invited them to play for her students at the Mesa Springs School. 75 years later, one of those students can still conjure the picture of the two of them that day, sitting with their instruments at the head of the class. She can still see Sarah with her regal, stiff-necked bearing and the young cousin's lively blue eyes, her curly dark hair. Sarah's cousin was so tiny, she could have passed for a grade school student herself that day. But she was like a miracle to those kids, working her Stella guitar so hard she busted a string and went right on playing. It was the grandest thing there ever was, the long-ago schoolgirl remembers. Sarah and Mae Bell. Not long after the schoolhouse performance, Mae Bell was invited back to Mesa Springs to perform with Sarah and AP. Half a century later, Mae Bell remembered the date plainly, December 13, 1925. "I'd gone to Sarah and AP's to do a show at a schoolhouse," she told her friend, Dixie Dean Hall. AP's brother was in the play, and he was going with the school teacher there at the school. Well, he was supposed to take her home, but he didn't. He came with me back over to AP's house, and that was the beginning of it. Everybody had been expecting him and the school teacher to get married, and I had a boyfriend, too, who was kindly disappointed. That evening in December, Mae Bell Addington fell for the most eligible young bachelor in Poor Valley, Ezra Eck Carter, AP's brother. That was Eck for you, charmed for life. Eck's friends and his brothers had been dragging themselves across Clinch Mountain in search of a Rich Valley girl, and one walks right in Eck's front door. And not just anyone, but maybe the finest flower on all Rich Valley. Here was a young woman, a girl really, who could sing, dance, play a guitar, ride a horse or a motorcycle or a running board, bake a banana cream pie to curl your toes. She also provided instant ballast for Eck's orneriness. She could sit for hours making new friends while Eck would sneak off after hello. She'd never get rattled. Hard work didn't scare her a bit, and neither did hard play. Meanwhile, she also thought Eck Carter was the most beautiful man she'd ever seen, which was just fine with him. When the older siblings first started making music, Mae Bell was too young to join in. And anyway, she was her mother's daughter straight down the line. She wasn't one to step forward on her own. She had her mother's stature. When Mae Bell first started going to school, she wasn't much bigger than the little doll she'd carry with her on the little rock footbridge. And she had Margaret's temperament. Nobody ever heard Mae Bell raise her voice. As a young girl, she was so small and unassuming that she might have disappeared altogether in a crowd. But there was something magnetic about Mae Bell. First off, her eyes were riveting. They were blue, but so pale they had a silvery mirror-like quality. And she had a way of making people see their own best selves in her eyes, because those eyes almost always looked pleased. Her hair was black and wavy, but when it was humid out, and especially when it rained, those waves would curl in unruly tendrils around her face. Mae Bell showed no particular genius in school, not in Ezra Addington's classroom and not even at Flanders Bay Singing School. But long after she hit her teens, she proved herself precocious in one way. After she pulled her mother's auto harp down onto the floor, she learned to play it. She moved straight away to banjo picking and claimed her first prize at a Copper Creek banjo contest when she was just 12. When she was 13, her brothers got a guitar. Around this time, Gibson and Martin were making guitars with stronger bracing for higher tension on the strings. The brightness of the new guitar sound captivated Mae Bell. Except for Uncle Flan's shape notes, Mae Bell couldn't read music at all and never would, but she studied her brothers and learned to play old songs by ear. Quote, "The songs we learned were taught to us by Mother, who learned them from her mother before her, who had in turn learned them from her parents. What gave the old songs a modern flair was her guitar." People hadn't been using guitar in country that much, says historian Mike Seeger. They had been singing unaccompanied, or they had banjo and fiddle for the most part, and the style of guitar that Mae Bell played had a fluid, flowing, rhythmic sound. a way of playing the melody that was plain enough so that you could understand what it was, yet still brought you in because it had rhythm and life to it. We'll leave you with this song, and we'll pick up with part two next week. Here's the Carter Family, of course, with the track entitled Bury Me Under the Weeping Willow.
My heart is sad and I'm in sorrow for the only one I love. When shall I see him? Oh, no, never till I meet him in heaven above. Oh, bury me under the weeping willow, yes, under the weeping willow tree. So he may know where I am sleeping, and perhaps he will weep for me. They told me that he did not love me. I could not believe it was true, until an angel softly whispered, he is proving untrue to you. Oh, bear me under the weeping willow, yes, weeping willow tree, so he may know where I am sleeping, and perhaps he will weep for me. Weeping willow tree.